It is Friday, July the 14th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, Nobel Peace Prize winner dies in Chinese hospital. Also ahead, President Trump in Paris remembering World War I.
We also pay tribute to the heroic deeds of the French troops whose courage at the Battle of Marne and countless other battles will never be forgotten by us.
Schools for the Needy in Jordan, social media around the world, and a new film from the French director Luc Besson. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Chinese human rights prisoner Liu Xiaobo has died. He was 61 years old. This follows a high-profile battle with cancer that made his death as controversial as his life. Liu, a Nobel Peace Prize laureate who spent his last 8 years as a prisoner of conscience, passed away at a hospital in China where he had been moved from his prison cell in the final stages of his illness. Liu Xiaobo's final days were marked by a public dispute, over quality of care and Beijing's refusal of a family request that he be transferred for treatment to the United States or Germany. Liu's promising career took a drastic turn in the spring of 1989 when he cut short a visiting scholarship at the university, Columbia University in New York, and returned home to join student-led protest in Tiananmen Square. In 2008, Liu and other dissidents and intellectuals issued a document calling for an end to China's one-party system. VOA's Jim Stevenson spoke with Andrew Nathan, a political science professor at Columbia University, about the impact of Liu Xiaobo's death.
I think it's a blow to China's prestige in the West, but I don't think it's going to have any impact on the Chinese regime. Liu Xiaobo is not really well known inside of China, and I suppose that the information about his illness and his death is not very widely known in China either. So I guess the regime will just continue on to the upcoming 19th Party Congress without any disturbance. They want to show themselves to be tough and firm. They want to show that to their domestic audience and to the international audience as well. And I guess they've showed it.
Is there a repercussion for China with Liu's passing and the fact that China seemed to show very little compassion for his care and allowing him to leave the country?
I don't think there's going to be any substantial international repercussion. Everybody's going to deplore, foreign governments have expressed different, with different degrees of diplomatic language that they deplore the fact that Liu Xiaobo wasn't, that his cancer wasn't caught earlier and that he wasn't allowed to get the medical care overseas that he expressed he wanted to have. So the governments have said things. The U.S. government has issued a statement already, and I think the Norwegian government has issued a statement. But these statements, that's the end of it, I think. The statements are in varying degrees mild and diplomatic, and there won't be any punishment after that for the Chinese government.
There is concern, of course, for his wife and other family members who remain in China. Will there be any possibility that at some point they may be able to leave?
I guess that it is possible that the government will allow the wife and her brother, those are the people involved, to leave. They've expressed a desire to, I don't know now whether they want to leave, but in the past they've expressed that desire, and I think she may still want to leave. And I think it's possible that the government will let her leave, because when the Chinese government allows a dissident to leave, that person goes into exile and becomes much less influential. That's been the experience before. They're cut off from the public in China, which was already the case with Liu Xia, but they also stop being such a sort of sore case for the international community. There's a sense in which they're situation has been solved. They've been freed. So they come overseas and they have a hard time usually adjusting and finding a role overseas. So exile, from the point of view of Beijing, is not that bad a thing. And so they may very well let her go.
Are there effective ways that human rights groups can carry on Liu Xiaobo's banner, if you will, beyond his passing?
He said himself in one of his writings how important it is for people inside China who are struggling for human rights, human dignity, to hear the voice of support from overseas, even though that voice of support from overseas is just a voice and it's just moral support. I think that the human rights groups overseas can't really make anything happen in China, but they can. It's amazing but true that Chinese people keep trying, small numbers but brave people keep trying to push the ideas of justice and human dignity in China. So I'm sure that they will continue to be Chinese doing that, and it's important for the outside world to continue to express respect and support for those people.
Andrew Nathan, professor of political science at Columbia, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Liu Xiaobo is survived by a son and his wife of 21 years, Liu Xia. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America. Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This is VOA's International Edition. President Trump has held talks with French President Emmanuel Macron in Paris ahead of Bastille Day celebrations that will see American and French troops marching together later today on the famed Champs-Élysées. The two-day trip could be somewhat of a respite from media scrutiny on alleged links between the Trump presidential campaign and Russia. But Mr. Trump faced further questions during a news conference in Paris late on Thursday relating to a meeting last year between his son, Donald Trump Jr., and a Russian lawyer. The younger Trump released emails showing he believed the meeting was to discuss possible damaging material against the campaign of Democratic Party presidential candidate Hillary Clinton. Mr. Trump spoke in Paris following his talks with Mr. Macron. He noted the 100th anniversary of the U.S. entry into World War I.
We remember the tens of thousands of Americans who gave their lives in that valiant and very difficult struggle. We also pay tribute to the heroic deeds of the French troops whose courage at the Battle of Marne and countless other battles will never be forgotten by us. More than 1 million French soldiers laid down their lives in defense of liberty. Their sacrifice is an eternal tribute to France and to freedom. French and American patriots have fought together, bled together, and died together in the fight for our countries and our civilizations. Today, we face new threats from rogue regimes like North Korea, Iran, and Syria, and the governments that finance and support them. We also face grave threats from terrorist organizations that wage war on innocent lives.
That is President Trump in Paris. Mr. Trump has been defending his outreach to Russia that was reiterated in an interview with the Christian Broadcasting Network. He also defended his son, Donald Jr., following the release of those emails I mentioned earlier that rocked official Washington. The emails revealed a meeting last year between Trump campaign officials and a Russian lawyer who offered damaging information on his election opponent. We get more on this part of the story from VOA national correspondent Jim Malone.
This has held.
In an interview with conservative Christian broadcaster Pat Robertson, President Trump said he gets along very well with Russian President Vladimir Putin.
But I do believe it's important to have a dialogue. And if you don't have a dialogue, it's a lot of problems for our country and for their country. I think we need dialogue.
Trump also used Twitter to defend his son, Donald Jr., after the release of emails that detailed a meeting during last year's presidential campaign with a Russian lawyer offering damaging information about Hillary Clinton. Trump once again slammed the Russia investigation as a witch hunt, but the president's nominee to head the FBI, Christopher Wray, disagreed with that description at his Senate confirmation hearing.
That's correct, Senator. My loyalty is to the Constitution, to the rule of law, and to the mission of the FBI. And no one asked me for any kind of loyalty oath at any point during this process, and I sure as heck didn't offer one.
The revelations in Donald Trump Jr.'s emails have put the Trump White House on the defensive and sparked concern from Democrats, including Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia.
Nothing is proven yet, but we're now beyond obstruction of justice in terms of what's being investigated. This is moving into perjury, false statements, and even into potentially treason.
Some Republicans also registered concern, including House Speaker Paul Ryan.
I supported Bob Mueller being appointed special counsel, and I think we need to let him and his team and our investigators here do their jobs.
Their furor over the Trump email revelations has once again put the White House on the defensive over possible links with Russia, says analyst Kyle Condick.
The constant stream of negative stories coming out about Russia is at the very least a distraction. Whether it actually poses a legal threat to the Trump administration or to people in the Trump administration, you know, sort of remains to be seen.
John Fortier.
On VOA's Encounter program, analyst John Fortier says public concern over the Russia probe is taking a toll on the president's approval rating.
When he fired Jim Comey, he went down, and he's sitting at about 40% now. Those are things that are not helping the president and not likely to go away right away.
The focus on Trump and Russia is also complicating Republican efforts to follow through on their pledge to repeal and replace President Obama's signature health care law. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
The U.S.-based International Relief and Development, the IRD, has transferred a number of schools it constructed to Jordan's government now as part of a long-term plan to build dozens of new schools and renovate 100 additional schools over several years. The state-of-the-art facilities in central and northern Jordan were funded by USAID, that's part of the U.S. State Department. I spoke with RRD's program director in Jordan, Rula Abdukish Kakuda, about the schools, which she says will educate thousands of young people, including those in poor and rural areas.
The Ministry of Education did an assessment to identify locations for prospective schools, for areas where there were no schools. Children either had to make a long commute, and usually it was by walking, or where current conditions had it that they were rented buildings and they were doing double shifts and very overcrowded facilities. So yes, the majority of these schools were built in areas where there were no facilities for the students to go to, and especially for girls. I mean, out of the eight schools we built, six are for girls, which is wonderful, because prior to having these schools in their own communities, girls either got to a certain age and then had no access to formal education.
I know it's no secret that Jordan is in a very volatile part of the world.
Yes.
I know life goes on every day and people try to live and succeed there. And the country's well known for being a good neighbor in the area.
Yes, it is.
Just next door is Syria. Now, we don't need to get into the politics of what's happening, but as a result of what is going on in Syria, lots of people have left that country and come into Jordan. Has this put any pressure or any burden on Jordan's school system? Is that a part of why these schools might be needed?
No, these schools are independent of the political situation around us. These are built based on needs for the Ministry of Education. Now, of course, with an influx of Syrian refugees and, you know, prior to that influx of Iraqi refugees into the country, it put a big strain on the resources of the country in terms of not just in education, housing, water, food, the prices went up and all this. But for the Iraqis and for the Syrian refugees now, there are other programs in place to try to get them enrolled in the schools and actually to do makeshift schools for these people within their communities.
When I say state-of-the-art, these truly are top-notch, very modern schools, are they not?
Yes, they are.
And so
they have all the amenities that I think we recently had visitors from USAID come and from our own headquarters in the States come, and they all commented that these schools are nicer than the ones that they even went to. The libraries and the labs and the spacious classrooms and the lighting and the playgrounds and computer rooms and community, like on the multipurpose hall where they can have functions and where Samah people and their program do a lot of their community work. There's fully accessible to handicapped people, which until this, these people, persons with handicaps, were completely marginalized. The schools did not have a way, you know, there's no way to get to the schools with lots of stairs and so forth. They had early learning centers. They had child care centers for teachers mothers who can also put their kids in schools with them. So they are beautiful, beautiful schools. And USAID has done a wonderful job in supporting, bringing education forward in this country, I believe.
Abdulkish Katkuda is IRD's Jordan Schools Project Director. Well, it's time now to find out what's trending on social media. Here's International Edition's Andrew Palchevsky.
Today, we take a look at social media around the world. And we start in Europe, where a new proposal says that employers in the EU do not have a right to spy on potential employees' social media accounts. This recommendation from the European Union's Working Group on Data Protection would prohibit employers from snooping on their job candidates' personal social media accounts unless there is a legal reason to do so, and only if the information collected is relevant to the job that they're applying for. If employers do plan on auditing their applicants' social accounts, they have to inform them during the application process. Now, while these measures are non-binding, they're expected to be incorporated into the EU's General Data Protection Regulations, which are set to be released next year. It's estimated that as many as 70% of employers have admitted to looking up the social media accounts of their job candidates and using that information to make hiring decisions. Next, to India, where that country has hit a social media milestone. According to Facebook's user data, India has overtaken the United States as the country with the most Facebook users in the world. As of this week, India is estimated to have 241 million active Facebook users, 11% of the 2 billion Facebook users worldwide, and overtaking the United States and its 240 million Facebook users. Among India's users, more than half are under the age of 24, and more than 80% are under the age of 34. Rounding out the top five Facebook countries are Brazil with 139 million, Indonesia with 126 million, and Mexico with 85 million. And finally, back to the United States, where 8 months later, we are still talking about the 2016 presidential election. A new study from the University of Edinburgh looks at the top viral tweets in the final 2 months of the presidential campaign and finds a clear winner, President Trump. His tweets garnered more interaction and reach than former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's, even though Clinton tweeted more attacks on Trump in the campaign's final weeks. Additionally, 62% of viral tweets were either in support of Trump or attacks against Clinton. The results are perhaps unsurprising, given how much President Trump has used the social network, but they also seem to back up a claim that President Trump has made throughout the campaign and the first few months of his presidency, that social media have been some of his biggest assets.
That's International Edition's Andrew Palchewski. You can follow Andrew on Twitter at APAL. I'm there as well at VOA Norman. And our program, International Edition, can be found at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
Someday you might have a driverless grocery truck coming to your door. The Oxbotica Cargo Pod, a driverless vehicle developed in partnership with online grocery giant Ocado, is loaded with storage bins and Selenium software to navigate around the city to bring you your groceries. Oxbotica Chief Executive Graham Smith says the company is still running trials in Greenwich, London.
So the trial is about learning about how these vehicles will fit in the environment as much as it's about the technology.
The driverless pod is battery operated and has 8 bins. You walk out, you push a button, open the bin, and get your goods. David Sharp is the head of Ocado Technology.
People typically order around 50 items, and so that means that the customer gets a big delivery, which makes it profitable for the retailer.
But Sharp says to make those small deliveries profitable, that's where the driverless vehicle comes in. For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. Well, a new film from French director Luc Besson called Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets opens later this month, and as VOA's David Byrd tells us, this futuristic sci-fi film marries the overwhelming visuals, as you might imagine, and some strong acting from its female lead to transport viewers to a distant galaxy.
It's the 28th century, and Major Valerian, played by Dane DeHaan, and Laureline, his partner, played by Cara Delevingne, are special operatives hoping to save the city Alpha from a mysterious dark force that aims to destroy it and the universe. Alpha is a city made up of 1,000 planets where alien species and humans have all learned to work together for everyone's benefit.
Welcome to Alpha. The city of 1,000 planets, where for hundreds of years, every species has shared their knowledge and their intelligence with each other. It's paradise.
The film is based on a 1967 French comic series, Valerian and Laureline, which a young Luc Besson devoured as a child. Besson, who directed 2014's Lucy and another futuristic space opera, The Fifth Element, said he had to quiet his younger self to direct this movie.
Even if this child bring you there, now it's a new deal. You're not 10 years old anymore. you have experience in life. You have to reorganize your way of thinking and your way of working. So I just hope that this little 10 years old boy is just proud of the film.
Dane DeHaan says that he shared Besson's enthusiasm for the story and was amazed to get the part of Major Valerian.
We were eating some eggs, and he was like, "Hey, I'm making the movie I've wanted to make my entire life, and I want you to star in it." And it was so, it was so overwhelming and kind of like surreal. I didn't even really understand what was happening. And he sent me the script 2 hours later. And I read it, and I called him, and I was like, "I love this." And I remember him saying, like, "Oh, I'm so happy, I'm so happy."
British fashion model Cara Delevingne says that working with Besson was both overwhelming and amazing as an actor.
It's completely overwhelming, but at the same time, when you're working with Luc, who's wanted to do this project since he was a kid, he knows every character, every situation, every environment so well that when he describes it, it's almost like you're there. So he was like the best tour guide of, you know, Alpha and the universe as anyone could have.
Besson says that his exhaustive knowledge of the storylines helped him take the actors to places that they could only imagine because the environments were inserted later in post-production.
It's more like the actors goes for a journey to the unknown, and I am Google Earth. So they can refer to me, should I take right or should I take left?
You should take left.
You know, I'm just like, it's not, I'm the reference in a way. I am like, they want to write a letter and I am the dictionary.
Valerian and the City of 1,000 Planets also stars Clive Owen as General Arun Phillitt, Valerian and Laureline's commanding officer. Musician Herbie Hancock stars as Alpha's defense minister, while singer Rihanna plays Bubble, a shape-shifting, exotic entertainer. And John Goodman lends his voice to Egon Cyrus, a Jabba the Hutt kind of intergalactic gangster. Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets is rated PG-13 for sci-fi violence and action, and suggestive material with some brief language. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
Many thanks you, David. I saw the trailer to this movie. It's amazing. Just to go see Rihanna transform from whatever that is she's transforming from into Rihanna, well, it's amazing. You should check it out. One more story for you. Moondust, that's right, moondust that American astronaut Neil Armstrong collected during the first lunar landing is displayed right now at a New York auction house as a symbol of America's glory days in space, and it's valued at $2 to $4 million. It's one of 180 lots linked to space travel that Sotheby's is auctioning off to make the 48th anniversary, that is, of the Pioneer lunar landing on July the 20th, 1969. We were all looking at our TVs then. The moon dust, the first example and a sample of Earth's satellite ever collected. Other items on the block include Armstrong snapshot of fellow astronaut Buzz Aldrin standing on the moon. That's estimated to be worth $5,000, roughly. A documented flight plan astronauts used to return to Earth, valued at $25,000 to $35,000. And a photograph valued at $2,000 to $3,000 of astronaut Gene Cernan from Apollo 17 seen rolling around on the Sooner rover through a valley of the moon. Amazing. Listen, thanks for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. Good to have you with us. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineers Carl Starling and Dave Magnus, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a super Friday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States and Qatar have signed a Memorandum of Understanding, laying out a series of steps aimed at stopping the flow of financial support to terrorist groups and at intensifying the two countries' global counterterrorism activities. At a press briefing in Doha, alongside of Qatari Foreign Minister Sheikh Mohammed bin Abdul Rahman Al Thani, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson said the bilateral agreement was the result of weeks of intensive discussions, in that it reinvigorates the spirit of the Riyadh summit. That Arab-Islamic-American summit took place in May and focused on the necessity for Muslim leaders to unite to drive out terrorism from their midst and crush the ideology that supports it. Among the summit's initiatives was the inauguration in Riyadh of the Global Center for Combating Extremist Ideology to monitor and counter terrorist messaging. Secretary Tillerson applauded the Emir of Qatar for being the first to respond to President Donald Trump's call to combat terrorist financing. The signing of the bilateral agreement between the U.S. and Qatar comes in the midst of a continuing diplomatic crisis between Qatar and a number of Gulf region countries, over claims that Qatar supports terrorism and is too close to Iran. Qatar has refused to accede to a series of demands presented by the countries, and the impasse, as well as the blockade, continues. The United States supports the efforts of the Emir of Kuwait, who is acting as a mediator in the conflict. Secretary Tillerson has emphasized that the United States and its allies and partners are stronger when they are working together towards one goal, which we all agree is stopping terrorism and countering extremism. Speaking about bilateral agreement between the U.S. and Qatar, Secretary Tillerson said, "Together, the United States and Qatar will do more to track down terrorist funding sources. We'll do more to collaborate and share information, and we'll do more to keep the region and our homeland safe." Mr. Tillerson was clear that terrorism is the great challenge facing the region and the world. The United States, he said, has one goal, drive terrorism off the face of the earth, adding, in President Trump's words, that every country in the region has an absolute duty to ensure that terrorists find no sanctuary on their soil.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.